distance. I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance.
The theater, the theater.
Hang out, Louis.
Theater, theater.
Hey, friends.
Oh, hi there.
Howdy.
Well, hello there.
I'm pretty excited.
Yeah. Huh? Back.
We're back in action.
Back in action.
We've broken form. We've been doing some bonus episodes, sort of. We're treating them like normal episodes, but we haven't done a playwright in a while. I mean, this isn't a playwright, but...
And
what a person to get our feet wet with again.
Right. Yeah.
We're back to form.
This one's overdue, too. Like this is
overdue.
I'm glad we waited this long, though, for someone like this.
But CJ, you've been talking about doing this for 4 seasons.
Yes.
I have. I mean, other than Les Mis, Andrew Lloyd Webber is probably one of the main reasons why I got into theater as a kid.
Interesting.
He's That's another awesome. Pete Buttigieg.
What?
Someone who got you into...
Yeah,
explain. Because Pete Buttigieg got people into politics that wouldn't have necessarily gotten into politics.
Got people over to the more left side than they would have.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome all. No, we're glad to have you. Welcome to Theater Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds made by 3 theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
That's right. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. And this week we return to form.
Yeah.
We're discussing the evolutions of the great playwrights by taking a macro look at 3 of their works. And this is part 1 of 3 of our miniseries covering the works of Andrew Lloyd Webber. That's right. It's Fantcast of the Podpra.
That might be the best one ever.
That's sweaty, bro. That's sweaty.
I don't know, Night Podther? Cast Podther? Or whatever we did for Night Mother was really
cast
bad.
Podther.
Yeah, Marsha Norman, we're sorry. But Fantcast of the Podpra, we had a bunch of ideas, but this is the one that felt the best.
It's great.
Jesus Cast Superpod was something we did a long time ago when we covered Jesus Christ Superstar, the movie, in one of our miniseries.
Yes, we did.
But so we couldn't use that one. That one's pretty solid. Fantcast of the Podpra. During this miniseries, we're going to be taking a macro look at the shows Evita.
Mm-hmm.
Evita.
Phantom of the Opera. And School of Rock.
Yes.
For those about to rock, we salute you. Now,
we salute you.
Because, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber, the king of rock.
Of course.
We'll get there.
We'll get there.
But this is a CJ's pick. We each got to choose a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
So CJ chose to actually do Andrew Lloyd Webber, but Scott chose the first thing that we're going to cover. So Scott, why'd you choose Evita? Yeah, this is to set it up. This is the Tim Rice ALW team up.
Right.
Evita,
1978.
Okay. Why'd you choose it? 78, that's right.
Well, I listened to what you both had picked, and it was a show that I saw as a young kid. I saw a national tour of it. I don't remember who was in it, but I had a memory of it. And then seen like 2 or 3 productions, but literally just hadn't dipped my toe into it in any way, probably since the movie, which I think I saw once in the theater and then saw it again on cable a few years later. So that was, what, 96 when that came out? And I just hadn't explored it again, and it sticks around. It has stuck around pop culture and
culture
in general, and so I wanted to re-examine it, and I have some thoughts. I don't know how I feel about it, so we'll get to it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Siege, you sound like you might not have enjoyed yourself during this one either.
It was interesting because Andrew Lloyd Webber, like I said, was a big part of my childhood. I've seen Phantom several times, Joseph several times, Jesus Christ Superstar several times. I've even seen Cats. I have never seen Evita, but my parents were always playing this soundtrack in the car. Patti LuPone and Mandy Patinkin have been in my ears since I was very, very little, and I'm very familiar with the soundtrack. And just kind of a... listening through from top to bottom, I watched the 96 movie. I found a live performance online on YouTube. And coming at it as a 38-year-old woman in 2023, and knowing also what we know historically about the Perrones, I can't celebrate this musical the way I loved it when I was a kid, I guess.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, cool. We'll get into the historical not cool, but side
it'd
of
be,
it.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to talk as we go.
It's also interesting. Yeah, I think, and I won't give my hot take yet, but I grew up on some Andrew Lloyd Webber, and you know it. It's around. Yeah. Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. The Donny Osmond version is a VHS that I still cherish.
Ooh, that's awesome.
You know what I mean? Like,
it was
love
a
that
fun thing. Production. It really was. He was tailor made for that too. Like,
Exactly. And it's got like Richard Attenborough and like,
yeah.
Like, am I right?
Good people. It's good. Joan Collins.
It's not a joke. Yeah.
And Cats was one of my first Broadway shows. I was in first grade in a touring boy choir, and they took us to see Cats. I think Sound of Music was my first one. Cats was my second, and Beauty and the Beast was my third. And I was on the same trip, which was beautiful. But so I know him. I actually stand up for Phantom a lot of the time as sort of like a. And we'll get to that next week, but as sort of like a guilty pleasure musical, I'm sort of like, no, I kind of link it. It makes me feel things, but I have opinions on that too, obviously, now on rewatch and like, whatever. But this one for me, I remember seeing the movie and then seeing it live a few years later, probably at like Music Theater Wichita, I want to say, and always just being so bored. And I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, it makes sense. But I was just always so bored. And then when I revisited it a few years ago, I was asked pre-COVID, I had just been asked to join the non-union tour of Evita as the male swing. That would have meant I would have played Perrone. I would have played Che. I would have played anybody. I'm white. You know what I mean? I'm very Irish, right? I might have some Cherokee blood, but it's not, you can't see it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's that kind of thing.
Well, come on, Evita was blonde.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
Sure, but yeah. I get it. You're being a troll. but really to me, it's like, I felt uncomfortable. I just fully felt uncomfortable. I was like, no, I will have to play those roles. And I've done it before. I've had to play roles where I'm not the ethnicity or the race or the background of the person that I'm playing, and it's tough. And it feels wrong, and you know it's wrong. And especially now in this day and age, I was just sort of like, I think I'm good. I'm going to tap out of this contract. So I tapped out of it, but I was fully studying the project because I was thinking I'm going to have to cover all these roles. And something I sort of realized was like, damn it, I got to my take. I'm gonna save it.
Okay.
Fuck it, I'll say it. My take, here we go, and we'll dive into it later, is that there's like four really good themes in Evita.
Yes, I
that
write
are
down.
Really catchy.
Yes.
And that are agreed. Really, really sort of like proof of Andrew Lloyd Webber's talent, right?
Agreed.
I think the rest of it is kind of garbage. And we'll dive into why I think that later. But he's also been accused of a lot of plagiarism.
Yeah.
And this taps into that a little bit. Phantom of the Opera is the biggest one where there's even been like lawsuits and shit. So we'll get to that as well. But all that to say, I like the guy. Drew Lowe Webb. Hey, Scott.
Yeah.
I would like to know more about Drew Lowe Webb.
I can't wait for this fucking part.
I know you're going to be able to help me out with that.
I can.
Do me a favor and drop that nasty stinger.
Scottpedia.
Scottpedia.
Scottpedia. I love how Ryan says it on the thing too. Okay, here we go. We're gonna break it down. We're gonna break it down pretty quickly, and then we've got two truths and a lie to play, and then we got a bonus trivia question.
Actually, there's two bonus trivia.
There's two bonus trivia questions, so this will be fun.
CJ, Andrew, you're gonna get your ass kicked.
Gonna wipe the fucking floor with you.
I'm gonna.
Whoever wins gets to make out with me.
Okay. Oh, great. Let's go.
By the way, listeners, and Scott, I don't even know if you know this. CJ and I had to do a short film recently where we had to like suck face, and it was profound.
Sure.
Go ahead, Scott.
Absolutely. Andrew Lloyd Webber, the Baron Lloyd Webber. Baron, so he's more than just a regular lord. Although he's referred to as the Lord, but not nearly as cool as a Duke.
But the Queen has to dub you this, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. He was granted that title. Yes.
He's beyond a sir.
Yeah. He's referred to as a Lord. Yeah, yeah. Like Sir Paul McCartney, he's just a knight. That's nothing.
I want to see them fighting in a cavalry.
Absolutely. Andrew Lloyd Webber was born on the 22nd of March, 1948, in Kensington, London.
Kensington.
That's where Mary Watson, her parents, live in the play Watson that we did, CJ. In Kensington. He is the elder son of William Lloyd Webber, who was a composer and organist, and Jean Hermione Johnstone, a violinist and pianist. His younger brother, Julian Lloyd Webber, is a world-renowned solo cellist. Musical family. Okay. Andrew was a bit of a child.
Like
the Osmonds.
Like the Brady's.
The Jacksons. The Jacksons. Andrew was a child prodigy. Not only was Andrew playing the piano and violin at the age of three, he began playing the French horn and writing his own music at age six. And if that wasn't enough, he composed his first musical when he was just 13 years old. It was called Cinderella Up the Beanstalk and Most Everywhere Else.
Oh,
that's a brilliant little title for a 13-year-old. Yeah,
I play the French horn.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah, I play the French horn. I still do.
I played it for a summer.
Did you?
No, I played it for 8 years, but I quit after high school. But yeah, I played from fifth grade through high school. I played French horn, trumpet, tuba, flugelhorn.
I played trumpet.
Baritone.
They all got three of the buttons on it.
Yeah, well, French horn and trumpet aren't the same fingering.
And if you know anything, CJ, it's about the finger.
Your French horn and is your left hand, and your flugel and your trumpet are your right hand finger.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I learned something.
And I had a double French horn, double valve, so I had an extra valve.
I think it's called doublé. You had a doublé valve.
I quit. I'm cutting all of this. It doesn't matter. Keep going.
No, you're not. In 1965, Lloyd Webber was a Queen's Scholar at Westminster School and studied history for a term at Magdalen College in Oxford, although he abandoned all that coursework in the winter of 1965 to study at the Royal College of Music in London and pursue his interest in musical theater.
Sure.
In 1965, when Lloyd Webber was a 17-year-old budding musical theater composer, he was introduced to the 20-year-old aspiring pop songwriter, Tim Rice. Their first collaboration was called The Likes of Us, a musical based on the true story of Thomas John Barnardo. They produced a demo tape, but it never got a backer. But I think that they did it. A few years ago at some sort of music festival or something, they did a presentation of it.
Sounds lame.
In the summer of 1967, right? Yeah, who cares? In the summer of 1967, Alan Doggett, who was a family friend and the music teacher at the Colette Court School in London, commissioned Lloyd Webber and Rice to write a piece for their school's choir. The resulting effort was Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Aww,
red, and it
you're
was
welcome,
all
community and theaters and around the world.
And scarlet and black and blue and ruby and olive and violet and fawn and lilac and gold and chocolate and mauve and cream and crimson and silver and gold.
I can't remember any of those.
I used to remember all those, but I can't no more.
That's pretty good.
Purple and white and pink and orange and blue.
Blue.
Blue. Blue. Lloyd Webber has been married 3 times. He married first Sarah Hugel in 1971. They divorced on 14th of November 1983. I don't know why it needed to get that specific. Together they had 2 children and a daughter, a daughter and a son. He then married English soprano Sarah Brightman in 1984 in Hampshire.
The original Christine.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I was thinking. Yeah,
he cast her in Phantom of the Opera, among other notable roles. They divorced in 1990, but have remained close friends and have also continued to work together. And thirdly, he married Madeleine Gerdon in Westminster in 1991. They have 3 children, 2 sons, and 1 daughter. They are still married. Andrew Lloyd Webber is a member of the Conservative Party and sat on the House of Lords as a Conservative member until 2017. There we go. Little Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Am I right?
Yeah. We'll get into the chronology next week and some other details.
Yeah.
But are you guys ready to play 2 Truths and a Lie?
Fuck
Let's
yeah.
Play!
All right. Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, we need a stinger. It's okay.
Yeah, right. Number one, Andrew Lloyd Webber was a one-hit wonder who performed under the pseudonym Dr. Spin. Number two, Andrew Lloyd Webber was almost sued for plagiarism by Pink Floyd. Number three, Andrew Lloyd Webber once invited the punk band The Clash to jam at his house after seeing them perform on TV in 1979.
I happen to know one of those is completely true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I happen to know one of them should be true if it's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other one sounds like a Scott makeup. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying those 3 things out loud. CJ,
yes, yes.
What is your choice?
I'm going to say 3 is the lie.
I'm going to say 1 is the lie. But I think CJ's right. I just want to say something different in case.
You are both, CJ is correct. That's
yeah.
right. So
CJ's right.
Yes. Andrew Lloyd Webber was a one-hit wonder. He performed under the pseudonym Dr. Spin.
That's awesome.
He released the
hits. Two Princes, the 90s hit.
No, that's Spin Doctors.
Spin has all different things.
Boo.
But he had released a hit single called Tetris in 1992. It was a Eurodance remix of the theme tune from the popular video game, and it reached number 6 on the charts.
Sounds bad.
Sounds awful.
Sounds bad. I happen to know about the Pink Floyd thing because we're going to talk about this. Actually, let's do it now.
Yeah, I've got the little breakdown. Yeah. So basically, it was an accusation of plagiarism regarding the 1971 Pink Floyd album Metal. The 6th track of the album, Echoes, has a riff on which Lloyd Webber allegedly based the opening organ riff.
So it's a 23-minute song.
Yes.
It's really long. But if you get to, like, I think it's minute, like, 4 or 5, it starts going... And it's like it like holds that, it keeps it up for a while, and it's really specific, and it's not the exact same key, but it's the exact same
notes
and melody, like basic idea.
Listen, Drew, I steal my best bits too, just don't up to it.
That's
Roger Waters pointed it out and said that it was probably actionable. But stated
but
that they just not did not want to go to court over
yeah,
it.
Yeah, they're like, we're fine. The other one that's really interesting is the Puccini estate.
Oh, right.
So basically music of the night.
There's been a bunch of them. We should
yeah,
say,
oh, there's tons.
Yeah.
But
I thought
Puccini
this was
going to
have something to do with Yeston.
What?
Because Maury Yeston put out a Phantom like right around the same time as his Phantom of the Opera, right?
Oh, no, oh. That wasn't, no.
No.
That was
not,
strangely,
okay.
There was no lawsuit there.
Okay,
no,
Puccini.
Because those were 2 things based on the same source material that is public domain. Oh, it's that.
Right,
it's,
right,
so
right,
they
right.
were. It was just happened to happen. But yeah, there was this other musical called Phantom that came out around the same time. It's actually kind of interesting. Have you ever seen it? It's not
I've
good.
I've heard songs
like
from
yeah,
it.
I've heard songs from it.
It's interesting. But... Also, we'll talk about Love Never Dies next week at some point, which is kind of interesting. But apparently Music of the Night sounds almost perfectly like a song from one of Puccini's operas, and in that was in like 1910 or something. And then a bunch of other stuff, like famous concertos and things that he's pulled from. But yeah, I mean, it's all very interesting. But so he didn't invite the Clash over, is what you're saying.
He did not. He did not.
Just doesn't seem cool enough to that.
Yeah. But are you ready for these two trivia questions?
Yeah, bring it.
Andrew Lloyd Webber shares his birthday, March 22nd, with another musical great. Who is the other musical great?
I'm just going to guess Sondheim. I have no idea.
Yanni.
It's fucking Stephen Sondheim. Yep.
They have the same birthday.
Holy shit.
Well, yeah. 18 years apart, but yeah.
And they also star in a South Park episode together.
Yes. In 2017, it was announced that Andrew Lloyd Webber was the second richest musician in the UK. Who is the first?
Paul McCartney.
Yeah, you got it.
Jesse J.
Jesse J. He beats Elton John, U2, and Mick Jagger.
Wow, he beat Elton John, huh?
Yeah. U2 as one entity.
And U2 is or one Bono. Entity. Yeah. Okay. No, because they have like...
Just
they
one
have,
person.
It's just him. No, I think they share everything equally. I think that U2 is always shared, even though Bono and The Edge do the...
Including force-feeding you an album on iTunes. Oh my God, I'm still mad about it.
Still mad about it.
Hey, CJ, you crushed it. CJ gets 5 points, yeah. I get 0.
I never win these. Okay, it's cool.
You say that every time, but you've won the last, like, 9.
I always win these.
Yeah. I always win these.
Half the time.
There you go. There you go. Okay, can I give a Andrew Lloyd Webber take real quick?
Yeah, do
sure.
I think he peaked with Jesus Christ Superstar.
Agreed.
You think
I don't
peaked?
Know that he's... Mm. I think he peaked with Jesus Christ Superstar. I think Phantoms has its merits. I think some other stuff he's done has its merits. I know people stand up for Starlight Express. But I honestly believe Jesus Christ Superstar is sort of one of the great musical scores.
Agreed.
Oh, and it's fantastic.
Don't I think agree. We can say that about any of his other works.
No.
Like one of the great musical scores.
No, and it's the one that has endured.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to bet that, I don't know the numbers on this, but I'm willing to bet it's performed a lot more than any of the others.
Yeah. People love a good Jesus story.
And like we said, Evita too. Evita has endured, but I would argue, and again, you know, hey, no hate here. No hate here for AL Dubs, okay, for Drew Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
But, Drew Lowe. But I do think Tim Rice is the magic spice in Evita.
Isn't he the magic spice in kind of every team that he works with?
I mean, yeah, he's the magic spice in a lot of... Well, I mean, he works with a lot of pretty amazing people with the Disney stuff, obviously. Yes. Can we do a little Tim Rice
we should touch real quick?
Yeah, please, do it.
Because, so they work together a lot. They do Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat together, as Scott said. They also do Jesus Christ Superstar together. They also do Evita, a show called Cricket. The Likes of Us, obviously, was that first one that they did. And then he helps him out with some of the songs for the 2011 Wizard of Oz, which we'll talk about later. But Tim Rice did, like, Aladdin and Lion King, Beauty and the Beast. And, like, those are Disney Renaissance magical musicals, all of which have been made into stage shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? He is, I think you're right, Siege. I think he is sort of a magic ingredient in everything he works on. And
if it's not him, it's Alan Menken. Isn't he the other one that does a lot of
Menken and Fishman? And anytime one of them are touching anything, which I think maybe they even kind of work together on Aladdin. I don't remember who wrote the songs.
You might be
for
right about that. The other interesting thing about Tim Rice is Tim Rice was the driving force for Evita. He was the one that went to...
Oh, right.
It wasn't Webber that came to him. He went to Webber going, I think we should do this.
And, wasn't it always like, I had a stamp back in the day with Evita's face
that,
on.
That,
let's write a musical.
Fascinated by it.
That's my Tim Rice impression.
Yeah. And he's an interesting guy, apparently. I've heard that he's a very kind person.
Huh.
And so I hope that's true.
Well,
that's
the worst story... rumors to have. Yeah, the story kind of goes that Robert Stigwood, who was this producer who had done Jesus Christ Superstar with them and goes on to do a bunch of huge
stuff. Yeah,
he's a big deal. In 72, he commissioned them to develop a musical version of Peter Pan, like a new Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were sort of at first interested, and then I think at one point Rice was like, I think I'm good.
Yeah.
I think I'm good on this. This has been done. So he steps off. Like a year later, he's going to a meal or something and hears this radio show about Ava Perón. And he was sort of like, oh, yeah, that stamp that I had that CJ brought. He's like, I had a stamp once that intrigued me that was Ava Perón. So he starts doing some research and he brings it in. And yeah, you're right. He's sort of the driving force behind Evita happening. He's the one who creates the idea of Che, the character. Mm-hmm. So let's start there. Let's start with Che, because I think that can drive us a little bit into the historical accuracy of all this. But first, what's this shit about, CJ?
Let me tell you.
CJ's breakdown.
Che Guevara weirdly narrates the life of Argentine actress turned political leader Eva Perón, second wife of Argentine president Juan Perón. The story follows Evita's early life, rise to power, charity work, and early death at 33, but it completely leaves out the fact that she and her husband were Nazi sympathizers. Oh, well!
Yeah. I think it does. I think it commits worse atrocities than that, CJ. I will argue. But we'll get there.
A couple atrocities for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe not worse. Worse isn't the right word when we're talking about Nazism, but.
Nazis! Misogyny!
Yeah. We'll step into Che in a second, but actually I'll start here. This musical is based on a specific biography that had been written that was based very heavily on accounts of anti-Peronist Argentinians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is like, there's had to be a lot of cleanup in the world from this musical about who they really were.
Sure.
Because this musical doesn't, like you're saying, doesn't really tap into anything real about them. It's sort of all based on these, like, people being like, ah, those stupid Perón. She slept her way to the top.
That slutty 15-year-old.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so since this is what introduced Eva Perón to a lot of the world, there's had to be a lot of sort of like sweeping up of like, okay, but no, you should know this about her. She was really great in these areas. She was really great in these areas. Not so great in these areas. We should talk about these areas as well. But then you have a lot of people from Argentina, from Buenos Aires specifically, who grew up at the time, who are like, no, she is the greatest thing to happen ever.
Right.
To certain classes and things like that. Right. And then there's the other side of it that are like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
All that to say, they create this character, Che, who I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Rice specifically comes up with it, and it's to serve as a narrator, but also sort of represent the voice of the lower class. But also, he's providing a really intense insight into criticisms of Ava.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, I noticed that, too. I got into
he
that.
He calls her out a lot. There's a lot of him being sort of like, you dumb bitch, oh, what a show. And you're like, yeah, oh, okay. Like, it's not that intense, but that's how it feels sometimes, right? Che? I don't know. Oh, he's supposed to be Che Guevara in the Broadway production.
Sure.
That's sort of where Mandy Patinkin goes with it.
And that's Harold Prince, I think.
Right.
Who
that's the Hal
really,
Prince ideal.
Hal Prince. And then,
right.
Well, because, yeah, then, but more recent productions have strayed away from that.
It wasn't even meant to be that. It was written as this guy named Che, who was sort of this anonymous dude representing all these things. Hal Prince comes in to direct the Broadway show and goes, what if he's Che Guevara? And they're all like, ooh, cool. And so they use that as the template. And then everybody sort of puts that on him forever. And then as you said, more recently, they've sort of stepped away from that. Ricky Martin played him in 2012.
I saw that.
Yeah. And I remember at the Tonys, them performing and us all being like, really? Really? Okay. But the reviews were okay. The reviews were sort of like, they were a little sexist. They were a little bit like, Evita's shrill but a good actress, and Ricky Martin's sexy.
Wasn't it like 2012? It was the first time they actually had an Argentinian woman playing Evita.
That sounds
on
right.
Broadway. Like, oh, I was I like, wow, that took them a long fucking be time. Well, you
know? Yeah, if you look at, you know, a lot of these lists, especially Perone, mm-hmm. is very rarely played by a South American actor.
Well, and if you listen to the original Broadway cast recording, he's just throwing in bird R's all over the place, where I'm like, his voice teacher must have been like, now you sound Argentinian.
Now you got
by
it.
Rolling your R's all the time.
Some of the original casts that are interesting are like, in the first concept album, Colm Wilkinson is Che.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You love Colm, right? Isn't that Siege? Isn't
I mean,
like
he was
dude?
My Jean Valjean. It's just another voice that was in my head all the time when I was a kid. That's
he's
all.
He's your dude?
He's my Jean Valjean.
Your guy?
Yeah.
And then in the West End, you have Ellen Page and David Essex. And then in the Broadway production, you have Patti LuPone playing Ava Perone. Now, I have this vinyl, so I've listened to it. Mm-hmm. It's good. Mandy's very... Mandy,
I love this thing. In it.
Yeah.
Putting oh, on what a hat.
Oh, what a show. I can't do it.
That's not bad, though. That's
oh,
not bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very Kermit-y.
That's Kermit-y. That was bad. But Patti LuPone, Mandy Patinkin, and then Juan Perón is Bob Gunton. And then you never really see, like, Michael Cerveris played him in the one with Ricky Martin.
Oh, wow.
And, like, yeah, it's... which he got a Tony nom for.
Jonathan Pryce plays him in the Madonna in the movie. Yeah. Another inappropriately cast Jonathan Pryce.
he's just like old slut British actor. Like I'll show up. No
yeah,
problem.
What's the race? Got it. Yeah. I'll do it myself. You're like,
just
no,
give me a makeup
stop.
Team, please.
All right. Got the makeup here. Yeah. You know.
He's the Mickey Rooney of our generation.
CJ touched on it earlier, and I really wanted to hear her point of view. Because I don't... what are we doing? What are we doing with our lives? But I walked away from it this time on top of the... just the historic ramifications of who the Perones were and what they'd done and what we've found out about them since this. She was still a complicated woman, and by all accounts, she did some good things and some bad things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
she was a political leader. Like, and, I mean...
this musical sort of Greatest Showman's her a little bit.
Yeah. Wow, maybe that's it exactly. That's a really great way to put it. Like, let's smooth out all these edges. Mm-hmm. And because I don't want to see what are the feminist themes here. Are there any feminist themes here that make you go, yes, that's one that could be retweaked or reimagined, but I couldn't figure out where to do that or how to do that
right
with this. And musicals are trickier that way because there's not too much you can take or,
sure.
or add.
One weird way I had to grow with this, especially listening to it from such a young age, listening to it with my parents, my mother constantly pointed out the fact to me. And this musical really, especially the original cast recording, puts it in your brain that, like, mom thought that there was no way she could be a good leader because she was a whore. She slept her way to the top. Yeah. And that's coming from a woman that... she got her Evita history from this musical. She doesn't know anything else about her other than that. And so I think I trusted my mom in that. But then growing up, I think you could take the feminist thing of like, well, if this is the only agency you can give a woman, at least she used that. But then there's also the icky thing of, according to this musical, it started when she was 15 years old, which is fucked up. And I read some articles last night about, like, there were rumors about her sleeping her way up to the top, but they were rumors. It could have just been people that were like, oh, well, she's doing well. She must be sleeping with everybody.
Right.
And imagine the attention and the backstabbiness that she encountered as a woman in that position in the 40s.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, in
Which actually, this is sort of the misogyny of this whole thing, though, too, is that we said it's like Greatest Showman. Greatest Showman heroizes Barnum, a horrible man, a person mm-hmm. who was proven to be a terrible, terrible person. They leave out all the terrible things. Go back and listen to our episode of Greatest Showman, where we rip it to shreds. I had to kind of dig into one of my students the other day because they were talking about it, and I sort of said, like, oh, have you ever heard of Barnum, you know, the older musical? And this particular student was like, oh yeah, that's the bad one, but Greatest Showman's the one that, and I was like, no, I have to educate you. And I wasn't educating like, your opinion is wrong. I was like, you have to know that I understand why you like Greatest Showman, but the content is irresponsible, and here's why. And this movie is sort of the same way, but for a different reason. It's a bit this musical mm-hmm. is a bit irresponsible in the way that it shows her, because you're right, Caesar, like we didn't need to show her sleeping her way to the top when that's unsubstantiated claims, right? And then the other side of that is it does heroize her by the end. Don't cry for me, Argentina. She's got her hands up in the air and she's doing like a Nazi like thing with her hands or whatever. Yeah. And you're like,
sure,
you look like Mussolini when you, you know, I don't know.
And there is one reference when they do the rainbow tour. This is the closest we ever got to them talking about them being cool with Nazis, was when she's in Italy, they make the comment that Perón's an awful lot like Mussolini. That's the most mm-hmm. we ever get out of that whole thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, I just had something on the tip of my tongue. Can't think of it right now. Sorry.
Tip of the tongue, the teeth and the lips.
I know what it is. They put this whole conceit forth that she's sleeping her way to the top. And the way that she's written, then she's like, I'm sleeping my way to the top because this is what I do. Like, it's written into her role. And then, right. I mean, listen, don't get me wrong. I fucking love Patti LuPone like I love Idina Menzel. Patti LuPone does not sound like a 15-year-old girl the way Idina Menzel does not sound like a 20-year-old in Frozen.
Well, yeah. No, but that's the theater of it all, is like,
sure,
you know, disbelief. But in the more recent one at New York City Center, or whatever the fuck that's called, they did a production where they did have a younger Evita and an older Evita.
That's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And I watched a TED Talk where the director, it was called TED Talk Broadway, and the director was talking about, like, our responsibility as storytellers and why it was important to cast a 15-year-old so that people can really see, like, no, she was 15 and this is the story that they chose to tell. She's almost doing it as like a battle against Andrew Lloyd Webber. Mm. It's this mm-hmm. sort of like, it's not that completely, you should check it out. It's only like 13 minutes long on YouTube, but it's her basically being like, here are the things that this musical like doesn't take into account, and I'm trying to take them into account.
That's cool.
And like show it in a different light, and it changes the musical pretty heavily and darkens it in a lot of ways. Like, specifically, she had this woman in her life who was like her best friend and confidant, who was the one who actually announced the death in the really beautiful way. That's the first thing we hear in this show, is the announcement of her death. That was her best friend and confidant's words. Mm. And it's chosen to be a man's voice.
Mm.
And like things like that, where it's just like, why? Right. Yeah. And it is that sort of Andrew Lloyd Webber, Tim Rice, like, they're, you know, they're male centric. They're men, right? Making musicals. So of course,
in 1978.
Sort of, right. Of course, that's sure. sort that of how they're going to be anyway. Worse. You know, and I spoke to the music a little bit. There's like, to me, there's like four themes that are really interesting that he uses throughout. And the rest of the music to me is a little boring, which a lot of people would fight that because they'd say, well, he's doing rock, he's doing pop, he's doing tango, he's doing Latin music, he's doing
flamenco.
And I'm like,
it sounds like a musical to me.
Well, yeah, and it's all kind of like the most basic version of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Where I'm sort of like, right, yeah, I hear it. I hear the influence, but it's also Andrew Lloyd Webber doing it.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so when we look at Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, you look at Jesus Christ Superstar, Joseph, those two musicals are heavily influenced by 60s pop rock, what British pop rock was doing at the time. They did not influence British pop rock. They were influenced by it, right? He wasn't doing anything novel in terms of rock music. He was just doing something novel in terms of musicals.
Yeah.
And so when people say, like, he changed the game, he, you know, he made this whole new genre, I'm like, I agree. I think I do sort of agree. He's the one who sort of taps into, wait, we can use, like, popular music. Now that, like, musicals aren't charting the Billboard right, like they were in, you know, 40s and 50s, we can use popular music to make them more popular. And he does it. He does a great job. And I think finding all those themes throughout Evita and doing them over and over again makes people, like, really nostalgic for it. And it's like, oh, yeah, that catchy, that. You know, like, that kind of shit.
Yeah, I mean, he can do a hook well, can't he?
It's like Pasek and Paul.
Yeah, it's like.
They can write good hooks, you know.
But it's not necessarily deep. Like, for all of his training and for all of his knowledge of it, there's something, and I don't know if I totally agree with you yet. By the end of the series, I may, because I don't know if he peaked with JC Superstar. Because I, but
well, School of Rock is a profoundly deep piece of theater. So yeah,
well, but that's what I was about to say. He becomes the work becomes a little vapid,
yeah,
a little pop centric, a little light, and I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see, in especially after he passes, and God forbid, may not pass for another 20 years. He's what, 73? But, like, it'll be interesting to see how he endures. That's what I'm interested in, because I just don't know. Like, yeah. I expected to sit down and just hate him. I was gonna chastise CJ. I was like, this is the revenge for Joe Dorowski. And I'm like, no, I do like this. Like, there's so many songs in Evita that I was just like, God damn, that's a good song, and God damn, is it performed well. But what does it add up to? And yeah. I don't know.
Another thing I think this musical gets pretty right, and maybe it's just me still being very attached to the original soundtrack, like I think Jesus Christ Superstar gets right as well, is the idea of a crowd and loving someone leading into hysteria, even.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. I mean, like, when I was looking up things about this musical, if you really think of it, there's three big characters. And then there's the singer that she meets in the beginning. And then there's Perone's girlfriend that she kicks out of bed. And then yeah, that's it. Everybody else is ensemble in this.
It's only five named characters, right?
Yeah.
Then the ensemble.
And this is all. And I'm always looking for this because I've been in ensemble so much in different musicals. This is a fun musical to sing in the ensemble, I think.
Oh, and the bigger the better with it, too.
Yeah.
Like, I could see a small community theater production using 10 people to do it, but man, if you can put 40 on stage, holy shit. Like,
oh, yeah.
the power of those voices together. And
yeah,
and
not in California though, because of AB5.
Well, yeah. And then and that's something else that I do think
California
that he does well.
Community theaters don't need to do Evita though. No. You know what I mean? Like, right, that's not enough. The art we need to be producing.
Right. But like, he does a great vocal and choir arrangements and that are really striking to me. Yeah. It left me spinning for sure.
Who is, and I don't want you to necessarily answer this right now unless you have an answer, because we have two more episodes to really discuss this. Who is the film director equivalent of Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Ooh.
Like, in terms of career. And the reason I ask that is because we're talking about when his career peaked and didn't and things. And, like, the obvious, I think, first thought is, like, Spielberg, because they're both hyper famous. But then I'm like, no, Spielberg is more...
I immediately thought Michael Bay.
No. What? Way off base. No. I think in terms of career, though, I'm talking, like... Okay. Like, trajectory of career. And my first thought is Danny Boyle, only for the fact that Danny Boyle has, like, two, like, pretty major hits and then, like, none for a long time and then a couple of bigger ones later in life. And I feel like that's
He's kind of all over the map, too.
Yeah.
So
think about that. We have two episodes, yeah, I think, on that. I don't know why I'm thinking about that.
My first instinct was Bogdanovich.
Okay.
But he's a different, you know, because he was hot out of the barrel and hits two or three major things and then kind of...
But I would argue Bogdanovich doesn't have the lasting name recognition.
No, I agree
Weber
with you
does.
There. Yeah, I'll think about that.
Think about it. I want to talk through the awards of Evita real quick.
Jesus, yeah.
Let's do it.
So the year it comes out on Broadway, it gets 11 Tony nominations. Big deal. Now, it also got like Drama Desk and all the Laurence Olivier shit, all that kind of stuff. But it gets 11 Tony noms. It wins 7. It gets Best Musical, Best Book, Best Score. Lupone wins, Patinkin wins, Lighting Design wins, and then Hal Prince wins for directing.
All right.
So that's fucking rad. Then The Revival in 2012 gets 4 noms, including Michael Cerveris as Perrone. Ricky did not get a
nom. Oh, Ricky.
It's kind of sad.
Who played Evita in that production?
I believe that was Paige. No, Elena Roger.
Oh. That was the one that I thought they said it was an actual Argentinian.
She is. She's from Buenos Aires, and she won the 2009 Laurence Olivier Award for The Revival. So she did end up getting an award, just not the Tony.
Okay.
But she also was in Boeing, Boeing and Passion, which is Sondheim, on the West End. She's a big deal. But yeah, she's from Buenos Aires and has done a bunch of shit.
That's cool.
Right on.
Yeah.
Oh, she's been in some really cool stuff. She was in 9, Beauty and
Ooh,
the Beast.
Oh, I love 9.
Fiddler on the Roof, Les Mis. She was Fantine.
Okay. And so was Patti LuPone, right? She was Fantine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds right.
Fantastic.
What are some songs you like? Oh, what, Siege? What?
Well, let's do this. Do we want to talk about the Madonna movie at all?
Yeah, we can.
Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely.
What? Let's do favorite songs. I actually made a list because I have a lot.
Tell me about your songs.
I love Buenos Aires. I love Rainbow Tour and The Money Kept Rolling In. And then
The Money Kept Rolling In.
So much fun. I love the whole track of On the Balcony of Casa Rosada, which is Perón's speech into Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, into her speech at the end.
Right. Scat?
Man, I love that opening number and the, what you call it, the memorial.
The funeral procession.
I just was like,
I think I found my perfect Patinkin.
Patinkin.
I think I found him.
I can't go that high. She
you
said.
Can't do the Patinkin.
But yeah, and then Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. Like, I remember, I think it was. Oh no, it couldn't have been.
As a singer, it's boring as fuck. But
yeah.
Everyone loves it.
But yeah, that's where I'm at. What about you,
Bae? What about you, Bae?
I like High Flying Adored.
High Flying Adored.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So young.
And call us Mandy.
I like New Argentina because I just like the like.
It's very Les Mis-y, isn't it?
Yeah, and then anytime she comes in with her like intense.
Screw the middle classes.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
The songs are interesting. There's some good stuff in there, especially like on stage. It's all very epic, and I get it. It just doesn't hit like some of his other stuff for me, and I get why people like it though. Okay, let's talk about the film, the 1996 Madonna, Antonio Banderas,
Jonathan Price. Film. I hadn't seen it. I think I saw it in theaters because in 96, 12-year-old CJ was like, they're playing my song. They're making a movie that I give a shit about. I am going to see this. And then I went and saw it. Oh, and my mom saying like, well, that's perfect that Madonna's playing Evita because she's a whore too.
Jesus Christ.
But then went in and saw it and was like, oh, there's a lot of electric guitar in it. I just rewatched it last night.
Yeah, whoever did the arrangement of it, and it sounded weird. I remember it sounding weird.
Well, and for a second I was like, is this going to be a precursor to all of the movie musicals that they're doing now? And I secretly wanted it to be, and it's not. It's not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting one. I remember I had a choir teacher growing up, the one who actually took me to New York, who was obsessed with this movie. He was like, this is the best film adaptation from a musical. And we were like, okay, sure. Right. He really stood behind it. He had a giant, giant, like 8 foot by 5 foot poster of Evita, the movie, in his choir room.
With her hugging Che.
Correct, that one. But some interesting things about the film is that there was a time where Oliver Stone was going to direct.
Yes, no, I remember shit. That. Yeah.
And he ended up dropping it. But he did cast Antonio Banderas, and he had also cast Michelle Pfeiffer, and she dropped. Mm. So Michelle Pfeiffer was supposed to do it at one point, which would have been interesting. We've talked about her a bit. She played Velma Von Tussle in the 2007 Hairspray film.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah.
So she sings, she does stuff. And then at one point, the new director considered Glenn Close, because she does, you know, she's done a lot of Broadway. And then Sunset Boulevard. And then Meryl Streep was considered at one point. But Madonna actually came in and was like, I have to play this role. And did a whole rigmarole, and they gave it to her.
Did she request the extra song?
That was a song that had been written for the show that was pulled when it was taken to Broadway.
Oh,
and they added
okay.
it back in. That was a director choice to add it back in.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if that was a Hairspray situation where they were like, want to write all this extra music for you.
No, it was actually because they felt like most people didn't know the history, and it gives a lot of history in that song of her. And they also put it in international productions because people don't know who she is. So like in Japan and Turkey and things like that, they've put that song back in because they feel like it gives more context.
Does some explaining.
One thing I thought that they tried to do in this movie that I thought was right was they showed you her actual childhood of them not letting her into her father's funeral because he didn't claim her family.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And instead of giving the one solo to the girlfriend of Perone that Evita goes and kicks out the, so what happens now? That instead, what happens is the singer that she gets with, Agustin Magaldi, that she has an affair with, she follows him around, and then he basically leaves her at the front stoop when he goes home and sees his wife and children.
Yeah. Okay.
And she gets that song then.
That's one of the themes that you just sang. That's one of the themes that's like one of the four themes that they use like 500 billion times.
Yes. So they kind of try to put it out there that it's like, she's a kid and she's getting fucked over and she's looking for love in all the wrong places. And I did appreciate that. And they hearken back to her fucked up childhood towards the end of the film. And you don't see that as much in the stage version.
Yeah.
But it's fine. I'm glad I rewatched it. I'm not going to sit down and watch it again in a hurry.
It's certainly well made, and the production design's really great on it. But there's something that just doesn't work about it. And you know, the problem with putting somebody like Madonna in it is that you can't get past that it's Madonna. You know, it's like, oh, it's Madonna.
She looks
being
great.
Evita.
She's
beautiful, and she's talented as hell. I love me some Madonna. I'm just saying that sometimes personalities get in the way, you know, that whole, for years, Al Pacino would never do interviews because he's like, I just don't want people to know who the fuck I am.
Sure.
The more you know me, the less I can disappear.
I was sort of introduced to Madonna by this movie, though. Oh. So I was kind of like, I didn't really know who she was. I had just been told she was a famous singer. Mm-hmm. And then, because, you know, I was pretty young. I was like 6 or 7 when this came out and I saw it, you know. Mm-hmm. I do remember being pretty terrified by the beginning. Like, it's all very morose, and it's a lot of, like, chanting and a lot of, like, kind of dark corners and stuff, churches, and you're like, oh, my God, you know? And the people feel angry. Like, when mobs would get angry when I was a kid, I'd get really, like, stressed out and upset, and this has a lot of that. But yeah, it's an interesting film. I don't know. I didn't rewatch it for this. I feel like maybe I will now. I don't know.
Yeah, Madonna. I mean, and while Madonna is a great performer and singer and always has been, she just did, in my opinion, she didn't have the pipes for this. And then you're missing musical parts of the show that you love so much that they are literally rewriting lines for her so she can sing it because she can't get up as high as the score calls.
Well, that was sort of what Lapone apparently has never seen the movie and has never really engaged with it in any way, except apparently one time she heard some tracks, and when asked about it, she was like, it's just unfortunate that they had to change the keys to everything because it doesn't emotionally impact as, like, that's, you know, the reason it was written that way is the reason. Yeah,
very,
I mean,
savvy note, you know.
Not wrong. But, you know, she took from the same voice teacher as Patti LuPone, and she, like, really tried, and she, you know, she really wanted
this. Yeah, she worked her ass off for it.
She wanted to prove what she can do, and it was interesting. Let's get out of here. Evita is very interesting, but, like, we have two more weeks to talk Weber, so I want to do that. But is there anything else y'all want to say before we get out of here?
Good pick. I loved going back and it'd been a while since I'd spent any time with this musical, so it was nice to go back and spend time with it as an adult.
Yeah. It's kind of, like I said, it's a little bit of a conundrum puzzle for me, because I'm glad that I went and revisited it, and I just don't know what I think. I didn't hate it. I didn't hate it by any stretch, but there's something about it that's...
There are other musicals of his that I would hate more to spend time on.
But yeah, I'm gonna be pondering it. I might have comments at the beginning of next week because I need to think about it still.
Can't do it.
No way.
Sweet. So let's get out of here. Yeah, are we done? Are we? Yeah. You want to spotlight some LA theater?
I do have some. I do have some spitlets. Let's
spitlet.
Let's do that.
LA Spotlight.
CJ, would you like to start?
I would love to. Y'all have one weekend left to see Amanda Blake Davis, who see her directing of Not Now at the Brick House Theater in NoHo, North Hollywood. It's through March 5th, Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 3.
Awesome. I've got five here. Do You Feel Anger, playing at Circle X, still getting a lot of hype, and I think it closes this weekend, not this weekend as we record, but this weekend as we...
March 5th, I think.
Thank you,
Day.
It's getting fantastic word of mouth. Go check it out at Circle X Theater. On all the social medias. Appropriate at South Coast Rep also, I think, just opened up and is getting some really nice reviews. Check out South Coast Rep to get more information. Come Get Maggie is opening at the opened just this past weekend at Rogue Machine LA. Go check it out. Again, getting a lot of good hype. And then finally, The Dry Years by Ghost Road Theater is getting some really nice reviews. It's at the Broadwater LA, but check it out at Ghost Road Theater on the socials and interwebs. That's what I got.
Good times, y'all. Yeah.
Good times.
We love spotlighting LA theater. If you have something that you want to spotlight that's near or around Southern California, let us know and we'll spotlight it here.
Hell yeah.
We sure will.
We'll share
it. Sure will, dear.
Sure.
But thank you for joining us for part one of three of Fantcast of the Podpra. That's right. Andrew Lloyd Webber. Join us next week for part two, where we'll be covering Poto, Phantom of the Opera.
Can't wait.
And then part three is School of Rock, which is my pick.
Yes, it was.
But next week we'll also do the chronology. We'll step through the whole thing. It'll be great.
Yes. Y'all have questions, comments, or compliments, you can reach out to us via email, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Our theme song is better than your theme song.
Bitch.
He also writes all of our
stingers. It's rude. Honestly, it's rude. That's fine.
I didn't mean it. I'm sorry.
And he also writes all of our stingers, and he's a fantastic person. And finally, to the great award-winning playwright Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes and doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're gonna buy you a beer.
Hey, Scott.
Yeah.
You're my Scriker.
Aw, thanks. Oh, I want to do that show so bad.
I know.
Yeah.
Good times. Subscribe, rate, review. It really does help. And we'll see y'all next time. Go listen to some Drew Lo Webb.
Drew Lo! Drew Lo!
I spend my days just mooning all over you, all over you. I spend my nights just mooning, so sad and blue, so sad and blue. It's from Greece.
From Greece. Stage play.
Which we'll be talking about soon.
Later, everybody.
The theater. The theater.
Sing out, Louis.
Theater. Theater. To be or not to be.